Acquisition number 12724, Reel 3.
Mr. Tremble, Reel 3.
We had a very short stop in Sicily, really. And then we went over into Italy, on the mainland. And our first airfield was a place called Vesuviano, which is right at the base of Vesuvius. And we stayed there for quite a considerable time. During the battles of Cassino and all the other minor battles round about that, until Cassino had fallen. And they moved up, and we went all up the east coast of Italy, finishing eventually in Treviso, outside Venice. And it was whilst we were there that the war ended.
What did you think of 601 Squadron as a squadron?
A wonderful squadron. A wonderful squadron. The esprit de corps, the comradeship, the inspiration to do one's utmost at one's job, came more to me in 601 than it had done at any time before in my life. That we revered our pilots, we nurtured our pilots, we made sure their job was as easy as they could, as we could make it, because they were living on the edge of their nerves all the time, and they were just, we had the record 601 of most operational hours flown in the Desert Air Force campaign right through until Treviso, and we kept that record to the best that we could. It was broadcast amongst us that we're the leading hours squadron, and we kept that, maintained it, and it wasn't a drudge. It was a hard life. Very hard. We lived in tents most of the time. We lived in buildings that had to be DDT'd before we could go into them because of the infestations that had been left behind, either by the former occupants, the locals, or by our enemy. The only comfortable place we ever got was Treviso, where it was a proper, it's now apparently an international airport. There were proper hangars there, a proper runway, and buildings for some of the crew to get. But 601 Squadron was not lucky enough to get buildings. We still had a tented camp. Everybody was quite happy. By that time, I'd become what they called a blood tub driver. I drove the ambulance and kept the ambulance in repair and the medical truck. That was my job by then. Sitting on the airfield waiting for aircraft returning or for any eventuality that we had to go out. And it was 2 days after the war finished that I went out for my last casualty. They were giving a flypast over Venice. On the return to the camp, in line astern, the normal approach was to peel off, do the circuit and land. And on this occasion, number three came up before number two and decided to move, and took his tail off. Number two went in. Number three was fortunate enough to have enough prop left to make the circuit and come in and land, with the engine screaming its way out of its bearings. And we had to run off to where this other aircraft had gone in, but we found it 6 feet underground. The laddie was killed 2 days after the war. Was a waste.
You said that the pilots lived on their nerves. Was that obvious to you as ground crew?
Oh, the strain was terrible for those lads. They were hour after hour, land, refuel, rearm, up again, land refueled, rearm, up again. Targets were being supplied to them frequently. The umbrella group, as they used to call it, the people that were being given targets from the various army groups, and they were then requesting cover from the nearest unit to give that cover. Attacks on gun emplacements, attacks on convoys, attacks on a well-held position and whatever. And the aircraft were on call. It was like a taxi rank. That was the standard of squadron life all the way through from El Alamein to northern Italy. It was a call-up job, and they were kept called up, you know, as soon as they could refuel themselves as well as their aircraft and rearm, they were off again. The hours were from daylight to dark, you know, with just every hour that they had available for flight was made use of. We lost a number of our pilots, various things shot down, out of fuel, miscalculations, all these sort of things. Even landing with bombs still fastened underneath them and crash landing and blowing up, we had all of these things. But the morale was high and the purpose was maintained. There was no, at no time did we feel it wasn't worth it. It had to be done.
Did you have any so-called lack of moral fibre cases?
I've heard of that expression being used, but I was always so glad all the time that never, to my knowledge, was the expression used towards any pilot or any member of 601 Squadron 244 Wing, which we were all one big wing. I never heard it used, directed at anybody. I think we all were afraid most of the time. So to be afraid was no mark of disrespect in any way on a man. I think we were all afraid. But lack of moral fibre, cowardice, never met it. And I'm glad to say so. I knew there were cases that it did happen. And who's to say that those people were wrong? Who's to say that they were doing anything bad because they lacked moral fibre? Some of them had not lacked moral fibre for years beforehand, but there was a saturation point and they'd reached it. It was like a piece of blotting paper. After a while, it becomes useless. It will take all the ink you put on it. But it becomes useless after a while. And some people will have that maximum absorbency capability. That's it. They still did the best when they could.
Were you ever attacked on the ground by enemy aircraft?
On a couple of occasions, yes. But it was a case of how close is it? How good are they? Should we stop work? You know, it was just that. Yes, some very, very frightening moments. Some gripping is a word, I suppose. You know, you assess things very quickly. You either decided you were going to take cover because they were coming in pretty well or pretty close, or they were quite good aimers with their bombs or their machine gun. All the aircraft on Malta, when we went back to Malta, all the aircraft were destroyed except six on one occasion. But it was then just a case of the aircraft that were left had a pool of pilots that could fly them. So It was a matter of maintaining the aircraft in as much of a serviceable state as you could. The actual feeling of the man was that he could just keep doing that. It's just part of a squadron that's working to an end. There was nothing nicer than the 5th of May, 1945, when suddenly you realise that it was not necessary to rearm, refuel, and no more kites were coming back with the pilots shot up. You were not going to be carrying any more dead bodies in your ambulance. You were not going to be burying any more of your men. There was nothing nicer than that day.
You put here on the form that the squadron had something to do with escorting the Italian Navy.
Navy, yes, the first job from where we landed at Malta. The Italian Navy were sort of captured, as you might say, Taranto, and they had to be escorted to Alexandria, and the squadron was given that job of escorting them. And rather infra-dig for the poor Italian fleet to be escorted by the insignificant Spitfires, El Duce called them, the insignificant Spitfires, escorted his pride, his fleet, into captivity in Alexandria. And we felt quite an honour with that, the whole squadron, although the ground staff were not part of it. It's, you know, we just provided the necessary services to get them there. It's quite something.
Now, after the war, you were in Palestine during 45-46,
yes,
when the Zionists were agitating for independence.
Yes.
Can you tell me something about that, please?
Yes, we were put on a ship at Trieste in Italy, Yugoslav border there, and we were of the opinion that we were coming home, and we sailed down the Adriatic, a happy ship, blighty bound. But it was the next morning when, being in the desert, one becomes very, very aware of where the sun is. It's your compass. It's your direction finder. And when we awoke in the morning and came out on deck, instead of the sun being on the left of the ship, meaning that we were heading towards Gibraltar, the sun was on the right of the ship, meaning that we were heading east.
This was 601 squadron on the ship?
No, the 601 squadron had been sent back to Blighty. It was a Royal Auxiliary Air Force squadron. So as soon as the hostilities were classified as over, they were immediately brought back, the squadron, all its regalia and all its records, everything else, the whole squadron as such, all the members of the Royal Auxiliary Air Force were sent back. All the volunteer reserves were kept. The aircraft were also kept. And then they were taken off. And apparently they'd already been shipped to Palestine. Didn't know that. But we wound up going east.
But where were you with a unit going to Palestine?
All the ex-Royal Air Force volunteer reserve men, all the call-up lads and everything else, all those that had come in, not into the Royal Auxiliary Air Force, that was a separate entity, and we were just still a unit. And we still call ourselves 244 Wing, but the actual squadron was taken out. Yes, 244 Wing was sent to Palestine. We landed at Haifa after getting our destination notified by request from the skipper that he'd been instructed to take the men on board to Haifa. I think it was all predetermined, but nevertheless, we landed at Haifa and moved with our own transport down to a place called Petah Tikva, which was just outside Tel Aviv. An RAF station, a peacetime RAF station, a beautiful place, amongst the orange groves and the mimosa blossoms and all that. It was really beautiful. Our job there was to assist the Palestine police force, or the squadron's job was to assist the Palestine police force. Not the squadron anymore, it's the wing. All the aircraft of the wing were to assist the Palestine police force and the army to restrain the terrorists, the Haganah, Ergun Zvi Lehmi, the Stern Gang, who were kicking up against the British control of Palestine. We had 9 Spitfires blown up on the runway. They'd placed Gelignite down the air intakes. And when we went to try and extinguish the fires, we were machine gunned by them. And I got the opinion that the government didn't want us to come back home again. That we'd lived through the war, but we were going to be an embarrassment, so put them in Palestine and let the terrorists finish them off. That came to me there in Palestine, and I don't know why. Well, I do know why. I was being shot at. Somebody was trying to kill me, and there was no war on. And my friends were being shot at. And we had injuries. We had wounded.
How had they managed to get into the base to do this?
Very adept at getting into any of they wanted to. They knew those places better than we did. The protection around the base. We had one Rolls Royce armoured car from vintage 1925, I think, roaming round with a revolving turret on the top with a .5 single barrel machine gun. And they were able to attack us with the most up-to-date arms of the day that they'd gathered from various battlefields all over the place and whatever, but they were really well trained. Most of them had been in the British forces. Most of them had been trained by our regiments, our units, and they were skilled soldiers. They knew what they were on about and they knew how to get into things.
How soon after you got to Petah Tikva did this sabotage your car?
2 weeks. 2 weeks after we got in.
So this is June 45?
Yes, end of June 45.
Was anybody hit by the machine gunning?
There were 3 people hit, 3 people wounded. I was out on the... At that time I was doing fire engine duties. And I had to drive out with the fire engine. And it was one of the older type of fire engines. It had great big wheels, solid metal plate wheels. And as soon as I heard the firing coming, stopped the fire engine and got out and got down behind one of the wheels on the opposite side from whence the firing was coming. So I was pretty fortunate. But 3 of the lads were wounded and they had to have the ambulance out to them, take them back to sick quarters. Not badly, apparently, just minor flesh wounds, but nevertheless they were injured. So the stay in Palestine was not a very happy one, because 2 of the sergeants from our station were found hanged in an orange grove.
RAF sergeants?
They were taken and outside the camp and they were captured and hanged in an orange grove.
And did you know them?
No, they just the 2 men on the station. They weren't part of our group. There was a permanent staff on the station. We were at risk all the time, apparently, there. We only went out in groups. And we were armed whenever we went out. So, did have the benefit of going down to Jerusalem, around to Nazareth and Bethlehem at Christmas time. In 1945. then I came home in the May in 46.
How nervous about your own safety did you feel in Palestine?
You were continually aware that the threat was there to you and to your comrades. You were continually aware. 9 paratroopers sleeping in the back of a truck in Tel Aviv. Their job at the time was guarding the main synagogue in Tel Aviv because there was a faction trying to destroy the synagogues. And 9 paratroopers were sleeping in the back of a truck when a girl apparently went up to the back of the truck and placed a Bren gun muzzle through the aperture for the step and emptied a magazine in it. They were sleeping and they were guarding their synagogues. So your any idea of security, any idea of safety was quite remote. You were under threat and you knew you were under threat. So you had to be aware. The fact that those 9 men were sleeping without a guard was the omission that cost the lives of those 9 men. So wherever you did go, if you were going to relax, you always staked out a guard.
Always. When you say 9 para, you mean 9 parachutists?
9 paratroopers of the 1st paratroop. I don't know whether it was division or brigade.
Regiment.
A regiment. 9 paras were killed in the back of a truck, and it was by a girl who apparently was no more than 17 years of age, with a Bren gun, a British Bren gun.
But evidently that didn't stop you going about.
Well, they came to when it escalated to the after that paratroop assassination run, it escalated to quite a state of attack all around. St. David's Hotel in Jerusalem was bombed, and we were then restricted to camp. We didn't travel unless we were traveling on duty. And then we were in an armed convoy wherever we moved, you know. But that was very, very little. We didn't move about very much.
But before the blowing up of the King David Hotel, you weren't restricted?
No, not very much. We were pretty free to move about whatever we want. But under the advice that we travelled in more than twos, right? And we were armed all the time. Continual lookout. We were made very welcome by most of the people of the residents of Palestine, Tel Aviv and Jaffa, which was Arab and Jew living next door to each other. It was only like across the road and you were in Jaffa, or across the road and you were back in Tel Aviv. And they were living and working together in reasonable peace, I think. But it was only these extremists that later become the politicians of Israel that were giving the trouble. I don't know whether they were justified. I didn't even consider that wasn't my job. My job was to assist in the protection of property and life around there. And that's what we did to the best of our ability. But I was never so glad as when I was told I could come home in May 1946. I was relieved then. I was going to live. I wasn't going to have people taking pot shots at me. And I was going back to Blighty, something that we had almost dismissed in 1945. The feeling came amongst most of us that you've been sent out here, and your name's been crossed off the return list. You know, that was the feeling that most of us had. 8th Army Desert Air Force. We've been sent out. And definitely there's no return ticket. Italy also, that sort of emphasized it. And haven't we had enough? That time we went back, I was never allowed leave. Never got leave. Others got LEAP. I didn't even know what it was. I never heard about it, you know.
What was LEAP?
leave in advance of Python. Python was repatriation. Yeah.